This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire is experiencing its worst drought in a decade and a half, a fact noted by the Department of Environmental Services yesterday as it released a statement urging residents to watch their water consumption. The drought stems from a lack of snow this winter, exacerbated by a drier than usual summer, and the impact has gone beyond browning lawns. Some private well owners are already reporting their water supplies running low. Outdoor water use is restricted in more than 100 communities, and farmers are struggling. While parts of the state have seen a few thunderstorms recently, they're falling on hard, dry soil, producing more runoff than a good soaking for crops. Meanwhile, other impacts include increased fire danger, given dry forests and fields, and lower water levels in rivers and lakes. However, the dry, sunny weather is likely to make some tourism businesses happy, with no rain to dampen enthusiasm for all the outdoor adventure that New Hampshire offers in summer. Today in The Exchange, dry times in the Granite State. Let's hear from you. What's your experience with this drought, and what do you think is the best way to deal with it? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. Mary Stampone is here. She's the state climatologist and an associate professor of geography at UNH. And Mary, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, Brandon Kernan, senior hydrologist with New Hampshire's Department of Environmental Services. And Brandon, welcome. Good to see you too.
Thank you.
Well, Mary, just want to start with you. So how dry is it?
Right now, we have about three quarters of the state listed as considered abnormally, at least abnormally dry, with about one fifth of the state concentrated in the south that is experiencing severe drought conditions. If you look at the precipitation deficits, we're running about 50 to 70% of normal across southern New Hampshire, with rainfall deficits between 5 and 10 inches from north of Concord down south toward the Massachusetts border.
So untangle that a little bit for me, Mary, please. So a precipitation deficit. Just give
me a little
more there.
Difference between the amount of precipitation we've received so far this year versus what we would normally expect based on the average precipitation over the past several decades.
So normal is 100%. So running 50 to 70% below
yes.
what we would normally expect.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a lot.
That is.
You mentioned regional differences too, Mary. Tell us a little bit more about those.
So far in the north, some abnormally dry conditions there have been alleviated by some of the rain they've received over the past several weeks. But the conditions are continuing to be ranking within the abnormal dry to moderate drought to severe drought across the southern portions of the state.
And there have been a lot of words used to describe this drought. And, you know, to the average person, they all sound bad, you know, abnormally dry, severe. Give us a sense of what's bad and what's really bad and what is maybe not so worrisome in terms of that language that people use.
The abnormally dry classification usually occurs when we're kind of maybe moving into drought, when we've had an extensive period of lack of rainfall, which would be considered meteorological drought. When we move into the moderate drought and severe drought, we start to see impacts on soil moisture, vegetation, on down to groundwater levels as well as stream flow.
Groundwater levels, we should talk about that. And I want to turn to you, Brandon, as well. What has been the impact of this severe dry weather on groundwater, the water that we all use to, you know, drink and do everything else that we do on a daily basis?
Right. You know, groundwater does provide drinking water for over half the citizens in the state, either from the private wells or from public water systems. And they're at very low levels and have been now in the southern part of the state for about half a year. And so we're quite concerned, given that our peak recharge occurs in the spring, which is when the drought started, and now we're moving into summer where it's warm and there's more demand being placed on that resource, and yet it's already at very low levels.
Explain what peak recharge is. I think I know what you're getting at, but go ahead.
In New Hampshire, we really count on the snow melt in the spring season, right before the growing season starts, for water to get in the ground to recharge our aquifers, and that we will have essentially a reservoir of water underground that we can draw upon through the summer months and into the fall until the leaves fall off. And this past year, that peak recharge really didn't occur because we had a small snowpack. The snowpack melted very early, and so the aquifers were filled with a very limited amount of water earlier than usual, and now we've had warmer weather than usual, so people are tapping that resource harder than they normally would. So it's things trending in the wrong direction, both in a water use way and also in water availability.
So to use that overused cliche, it's a perfect storm.
That's correct.
Right. Mary, do you want to jump in there, please? The winter and then the spring, and now here we are in the summer, and as Brenda describes, it's getting critical.
Yeah, what is interesting is if you look at just total amount of precipitation, so that's liquid water plus melted snow, this winter was actually a little bit above normal. However, we hit a dry weather pattern in April that has just persisted since the beginning of spring, and so you couple the lack of rainfall with the lack of recharge from the snow, and warmer than average summer months, a lot of the water that would normally go into that system has been lost or not received at all.
Well, and it was a warm winter. I remember walking around in, you know, a T-shirt and shorts on Christmas Day, which was a little unnerving. A lot of our listeners, Mary, are probably saying, all right, what is the role of climate change in what we're seeing now with this drought? What do you think?
Well, this is a lot to do, of course, with the highly variable weather patterns we tend to receive here. But overall, projections for future climate change here do involve more precipitation overall. However, that precipitation is expected to come in more intense events. So we get more in short periods of time with dry periods in between. And as temperatures increase over during the summer months, the warm months, we are going to lose more of that surface moisture from those high temperatures, which evaporate, plants use it. And so overall, we're looking at, you know, some increased frequency of dry periods in between wet periods there.
That's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that because I've talked a lot with UNH climate scientists. And you're right. The forecast in general for climate change and its impact on New Hampshire is a wetter New Hampshire. So just help us figure that out.
It all depends on how we receive these the precipitation. And so they are we have noticed or observed over the past several decades we're receiving more rainfall and these more intense events. So we might get more rainfall, but they're coming over a shorter period of time.
So it's not as helpful, in other
words. Exactly.
Because it just kind of, boom, it comes down and it runs off.
And it runs off. And then you have a longer stretch of drier weather in between. So you get a lot of the rain and people think we're fine, but it all depends on how we receive the precipitation.
Can you talk about that also, Brandon, the impact of these sudden big weather events? And people say, okay, great, at least we got some rain and wasn't that a big storm and our drinking water should be fine now.
Right. Yeah, it's a very important point. In New Hampshire, I like to refer to it as us having Dixie cup watersheds and aquifers. You know, our environment doesn't store the volumes of water that are stored out west. You know, in New Hampshire, if you have a sand and gravel aquifer, it might be 20, 30, if you're lucky, 100 feet deep. Out west, it's 1,000 feet deep. And after that, you get your water from a groundwater sense from bedrock, which stores very little water. And so while we might get a lot of rainfall, we need to keep continuously getting rainfall to recharge this very limited storage that we have underground. And so it takes a very short period of time to stress the groundwater resource. And so we're in some ways more susceptible to drought than other parts of the country because of the lack of storage that we have.
The lack of storage that we have because of our geology?
That's correct.
So the Dixie cup, that means you can only it can only store a little sip.
Right. It can fill up real fast, but be dewatered real fast just as well.
Do you want to jump in, Mary? The bedrock and the geology and the impact on our ability to suck up what does fall down from the sky.
Yeah, we have to remember in terms of precipitation, when we receive it, it's used to do a lot of different things. One of it is to recharge our hydrologic system, but also parts of it do run off and that can cause flooding. We also some of it is being used to for plants as well as being lost to evaporation. And so that's where the temperatures come in. And as we do get warmer, we can expect to lose more of that soil moisture to evaporation in the atmosphere as well.
The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Today in the exchange, dealing with drought in the Granite State. Give us a call. Tell us how the drought has been affecting your part of New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477. And first up is Chris in Troy. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, wow. I didn't expect to get on so soon.
Go ahead, Chris.
I was just sharing with the gentleman that took my call there that I have a water collection system that has been fantastic. I collect water off a roof into above ground tank. Well, actually, it's the yard pool that I have above ground. And then I have it plumbed to two tanks under my deck. So right now, after this last rain, I've got 400 stored gallons for my garden.
Wow. Okay, so Chris, your neighbors are going to be coming over to your house to borrow your water. I'm glad he called because, Brendan, there are ways to be smart about the limited water that's fallen from the sky.
That's right. And we've been encouraging the public to implement water conservation measures right now. What the caller just references is a great activity to implement, where they capture stormwater running off their roof and store it in barrels, and they can use it for watering their plants or whatnot, non-drinking water purposes around the home. Something else people can do that will cut water use by 100% is essentially for discretionary purposes is just eliminate outdoor lawn watering. I mean, we're in a severe drought right now. We're not sure how long it's going to continue to occur. So to really just, you know, terminate the discretionary uses of water that aren't completely necessary so that you know you'll have enough water come the fall and winter and next spring.
So that reminds me that the Department of Environmental Services did release this statement yesterday talking specifically about lawns. Just remind us what your agency said, Brandon.
We've suggested that the southern part of the state that residents stop watering their lawns and limit their watering to hand watering of their gardens, essentially, that we are in a severe drought. It's an unusual circumstance. It's an emergency. And so we're asking people to work together to limit their use of this shared resource where it's not necessary.
And so that is a recommendation, not a mandate. But from what I understand, several communities, right, Brandon, have told residents, no, you can't do this.
Right. We have over 100 water systems that have either implemented a water use restriction or a water use ban for outdoor watering. And we've also provided municipalities with some guidance on how they can implement water use restrictions if they see a need to do that to protect wells in an area. And under state law, municipalities do have the authority to restrict or ban outdoor lawn watering during a declared drought, which we're in right now, and they can even apply that to private residential wells.
So some towns do have the right to go to, you know, Joe or Jane homeowner and say, you know, your lawn looks great, but you just can't water it anymore.
Right. If they see a need to manage the resource for the good of the whole, they can implement requirements to restrict or eliminate outdoor lawn watering during a drought.
What about golf courses? It's important that those look beautiful and green and pretty, and they use a lot of water.
Yes, golf courses do use a lot of water. You know, an average golf course would use 100,000 to 300,000 gallons of water a day. Some golf courses are sort of self-regulated around the state in that their water supply has disappeared during the drought, and so they've had to let their fairways go. Other golf courses are subject to some more current permitting requirements since 1998, and built into their permits are triggers that require that they reduce the amount of water they use when we declare different stages of drought. There are some golf courses that predate the regulation of groundwater withdrawals, and if they have the supply, they can use it unless we can identify some adverse impact to a surface water resource. There's really no control on that activity.
So some of the permits for certain golf courses say, okay, the city says, okay, golf course, you can set up here in our town, but if the water supplies run low, you have to agree to stop drawing off of the general public water.
Right. In the state-issued permits, which are reviewed every 10 years, we have two triggers in there. One, based on the measured groundwater elevation, that would require them to reduce or stop withdrawals. And two, just a tie-in to the declaration of drought at the federal or state level, if we hit different levels, their permits are reduced by 25% or 50%.
Well, the state's farmers have been especially worried about this ongoing drought. And joining us now from Westmoreland is Bill Fosher. He's owner of Edgefield Farm and coordinator for the Granite State Grazers, which represents pasture-based farmers. And Bill Fosher, good to have you. Thank you very much for being on The Exchange today.
Glad to be here.
So remind us what kind of farming you do. It's a little bit different, Bill.
I raise a little bit of everything. I raise beef, lamb, pork, chickens for both meat and eggs, and turkeys as well.
So not growing crops per se, but animals.
Right. And more specifically, growing the pasture that feeds those animals is kind of the main thing that I'm involved with and that the other members of Granite State Graziers are involved with.
Well, and I was reading just yesterday some USDA fact sheets, and it seems like people who raise pasture, raise hay to feed animals are doing especially badly during this drought. What are you seeing?
Well, on my own farm, I'm actually in relatively good shape. For a lot of unusual reasons, I didn't have animals on the land early in the spring. I tend to buy in animals in the spring and sell them in the fall. But farmers who are, dairy farmers, beef producers, and so forth, who are reliant on maintaining a certain number of animals year-round so that they have the calves and the lambs and so forth to keep their production going, they've really been hit pretty hard, and some of them are now in a situation where they're feeding their hay that was supposed to be for this coming winter just to keep the animals going through the drought, because the pasture that they would normally rely on has basically burned up.
Wow, so you're already using your winter hay during August.
Yeah, some of them started in late June, actually. One of the things that's a real concern there is that, of course, not only are they using what they would normally have been relying on for the winter, there isn't going to be any extra hay this year. I've heard reports of second cutting hay yields being down by, almost 80%. So people are getting, one bale out of a field where they would normally have gotten five.
One instead of five. That's a big hit.
Yeah.
What kind of backup irrigation system do you or your fellow pasture farmers have, Bill, if any, to deal with times like these, recognizing that, hay is a very different crop from, tomatoes?
Right. Very few farms have the ability to irrigate pasture or hay or corn silage ground. And that's partly because historically we haven't really needed to. It's a pretty unusual circumstance to not have enough rain to at least grow something. The other thing is sort of the nature of our land base here in New Hampshire. The hay fields tend to be small and scattered, and not necessarily serviced by, proximity to irrigation water supplies like a river or lake or something along those lines. And then there's also just the issue of the plain old economics of it. Irrigation of a fairly low value crop like hay or pasture, it's hard to make that make sense to be running a diesel pump that costs, 90 cents or more per hour to pump water onto land.
Sure. And Bill, I have a couple more questions for you, actually. I'm going to hold you over the break. And when we come back, one or two more questions about New Hampshire farmers, New England farmers like you who are dealing with this drought. So stay with us. More in a moment. The This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, dealing with drought. As you've probably heard, dry conditions in much of New Hampshire are having an impact on the state, ranging from dried up private wells to farms who are struggling. Today in The Exchange, a look at New Hampshire's worst drought in many years and what's being done to counteract it. Let's hear from you. How is the drought affecting you? And what steps are you taking to manage it? Again, 1-800-892-6477 is our number. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Brandon Kernan, senior hydrologist with New Hampshire's Department of Environmental Services, and Mary Stampone, state climatologist and an associate professor of geography at UNH. And from Westmoreland, we've been talking with Bill Fosher. He's owner of Edgefield Farm and coordinator for Granite State Grazers, which represents pasture-based farmers. And Bill, I did just want to ask you a couple more questions, if I could, please. Do you think that New England farmers in general are less prepared for drought than their counterparts out west, where it's a given that it's going to be dry for a long time? What do you think?
I think there's probably something to that. I mean, a lot of us now are realizing that if we have drought plans, you know, they were more intended for the kind of drought where you don't get rain for a few weeks, but that perhaps the overall season is, you know, kind of evens itself out. You know, I'm in a part of the state that's in a moderate drought. I have some friends to the east, over closer to the seacoast and south of Manchester, who are in a severe drought. And seeing the difference, just going, you know, 50 miles to the east where they've had less rain than we have. I mean, there's farms there that are really seriously considering whether they can continue or not.
Wow.
And, you know, some of that is because of this, you know, the shortness of feed. And dairy farmers are also getting clobbered because not only is their cost of providing feed for their animals going up, but at the same time, milk prices are in the toilet. So it's hard on everybody, and it's kind of demoralizing. I think that in the arid West, you know, the drought planning is kind of baked in, and the infrastructure there is kind of built up around the assumption that in some years, large numbers of herds of cattle in particular will just be destocked. They'll be sold either to other farms where there is feed available or ranches where there is feed available, or they'll be processed for beef. We don't have that kind of infrastructure in the Northeast.
Yeah, it's
where
very
you can
different,
just sort
isn't
of
it?
Move in cattle and move out cattle more or less at will.
Right.
You really have to, it's a major economic consideration to destock a farm. It's the sort of decision that a farm may not come back from.
Right. Well, Bill, good luck to you. We really appreciate
Thank
you being with us. Okay. That's Bill Fosher. He's owner of Edgefield Farm in Westmoreland and coordinator for the Granite State Grazers, which represents the state's pasture-based farmers. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And Mary and Brandon, let's go back to our listeners. And Robert joins us from Nashua. Hi, Robert. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead, Robert.
Actually, I was just curious. On a previous program, you had someone on your panel that had mentioned New Hampshire gets the same amount of precipitation, or historically has gotten the same amount of precipitation over the course of a year, whether it's, you know, there'd be a drought in the middle of the summer or heavy spring rains or a ton of snow at the end of the fall. Are we sort of beyond the tipping point of making up the you know, the 2016 calendar year? Can we not make up for this drought before the year ends?
Robert, it's a great question. And Mary, I'll throw it to you.
Well, we certainly can. If we have a wet fall and get a series of, you know, the coastal storms is what we would need to alleviate some of those precipitation deficits going into winter. So, you know, some of those, you know, 3-4 day rain events, steady rain events could take us out of it. But at this point, it's difficult to tell whether or not we'll have those events.
So we could still get out of it with some good soaking rains that last a couple days, Mary.
Yes, yes. But nothing too heavy.
Because heavy just means whoosh, runoff, right?
Yes.
So the National Weather Service has predicted that the drought may last through October. How do they make those predictions, Mary, given how variable the weather is? I kept seeing that everywhere.
A lot of times they're called outlooks, and so they look out over 1 month to several months, so on a seasonal timescales. And they use a combination of the climatology, so past records, as well as some of the models that will sort of project out a little bit further than your typical weather forecast. And so using some of the larger scale circulation patterns, they can get an idea of whether or not we're more likely to be above, at, or below the normal, which again is just, it's an average over the past few decades.
So the key words there, Mary, being more likely, but we don't really know for sure.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Okay. Because they seem to keep making that prediction with some certainty. This is going to last until October. I just saw that over and over again.
And a lot of that has to do with simply what we know about the system and the fact that we are in the warmest part of our year. And so precipitation, if we had normal precipitation, it still wouldn't be enough to overcome the deficits we have so far. It needs to get cooler.
I see. So that's why they are able to say that with not complete certainty, but some certainty, given where we're at right now.
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to jump in there too, Brandon?
Yes, I just want to comment. Even if we did get an increased amount of precipitation, while it will replenish the streams and reservoirs pretty quickly, there is a lag in that water getting down to the groundwater table, especially in bedrock aquifers. And we saw that in the 2001 to 2003 drought, where conditions on the ground looked great after the drought ended, but private wells continue to go dry for another 6 to 12 months after that because it takes a while for the aquifers to recharge. It's not immediate.
Wow, that's interesting. And you can't see that going on below you. You look at your flower bed and you go, that looks great.
Right, that's correct.
Well, and toward that point, Brandon, here's a comment from Noreen on Facebook. She says, please explain how low water levels affect all wells in the area. So many people comment to me that they have unlimited use because they have a good well. Noreen says, we are vegetable farmers and will not be able to water even with our drip irrigation soon. Wow, Noreen, I'm sorry to hear that. Can you explain how that works, Brandon, how sort of community water use affects everybody in the community?
Right. It's completely a shared resource. So while everyone might have their own well and their own lot, and some might be able to pump more water than others, they're all drawing upon the same resource. So if there's someone using an excessive amount of water, they are dewatering their neighbor's well and possibly the neighborhood's, the wells in the whole neighborhood. And so it's important that you not just think about how well your well is performing, but you think about your impact on your community and your neighbors and really think about it and be caring and really stop the discretionary water uses right now in the areas that have a severe drought.
Because we're all sipping from the same Dixie cup.
That's right.
Well, and towards that Dixie cup analogy that you used earlier, Brandon, here's one from Matt in Keene, an email. Your guest mentioned that we should terminate discretionary use so that we have water in the fall and winter months. But the Dixie cup analogy made me think that conservation will have only a very near-term benefit, but it won't help us many months from now since reservoirs are so limited in size. Matt asks, this makes me wonder just how big are these Dixie cups? Will they last us 3 months, 6 months, a year? Matt, thank you for the question. And I'd love your thoughts on that, Brandon, as well.
Well, one thing we know for sure is if you limit how much water you're using, the water in the aquifer will be preserved longer. So it's, you know, without knowing exactly the volume of water in the aquifer that you're drawing from, you know if you use less, it'll last longer. And so that's the prudent thing to do. Relative to how long wells can last during a drought, it's a different story based on the geology and the location and the topography of the state. Deep wells on top of ridges and hilltops with their essentially in a ledge environment will be more susceptible to going dry than a well down in a valley. sometimes you can look back on how long the well's been around. If it's made it through the 60s drought and the 2001-2003 drought, that's an indicator that it's more resilient. Some newer wells that haven't been stressed yet, it's hard to say how long they can withstand a severe drought.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned past droughts, and you're right. There was one in the early 2000s. Mary, what have we learned about drought management and how often New Hampshire gets these occurrences?
Well, abnormally dry conditions are not uncommon. And in fact, portions of the state have been classified as abnormally dry since, fall of 2015? Oh, March, actually, of 2015. And so that's fairly common. Moderate drought tends to happen at least for part of the year over the past 5 years or so. There was a period of time in the sort of the late 2000s where we had a lot of precipitation and we were fairly wet. But since about 2010, we've been in moderate drought. This is the first time
since 2010, really?
Yeah. For not very long, though. Several weeks, maybe to a month, so sure. Short periods of time. But it has been really since the 2001-2003 drought where we've seen the severe drought conditions.
What do you think people learned from that last drought? I'll throw this to either one of you. You want to jump in first, Brendan, just about how to use water, how to not use water?
Well, certainly there's a lot more information obtained about how much we can reduce our water use by eliminating outdoor water use. There's been a number of studies that included participation of communities that analyzed water use data that saw for water systems in the state that their water use could increase by 100% in the summertime due to outdoor watering. So if you compared how much water is used in December, where very little outdoor watering is occurring, versus that of August, 100% more water is being used. And so there's been a lot of focus by water systems and state to really encourage the public to reduce that, even when we have normal conditions, and to let them know how much water is really needed to maintain a lawn if that's really important to you. Another thing that's happened is water systems really have improved since that drought. Some systems have developed new sources. Some systems like the City of Portsmouth have developed an integrated management plan where they have a series of wells and surface water reservoirs, and they have a cycle of resting them and using them that optimizes their capture of water so that they can withstand a drought. Other systems like Salem and Seabrook have implemented just amazing improvements in metering their water use and conservation efforts. And so they're much better positioned now than they were at that time.
Well, a friend of mine has a rain barrel, and I've been helping to take care of her plants while she's away. And I'm feeling a little guilty now listening to you talk. I don't have one. And it's a good idea. She's got a ton of water in there. So
yes, and it not only benefits the environment from a water quality standpoint, you stop that runoff from an impervious surface, which can flush nutrients out of the environment
right.
into our surface water bodies, and so it's good for several reasons.
Well, we talked earlier about agriculture, and I want to return to that for a moment and bring on the line Bruce Silley. He's New Hampshire's State Executive Director of the USDA Farm Service Agency. And Bruce Silley, good to have you. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good morning, Laura.
Well, we talked earlier with a farmer who raises animals and pasture for them, and he talked about some pretty dire situations for some farmers who raise animals on pasture and who grow hay and so forth. What about other types of farms, Bruce? What can you tell us about how other types of growers are doing here in New Hampshire?
Well, I think that statewide, there obviously we have some drought situations, and it affects all of our agricultural people in the state, no matter whether they're livestock operations, dairy operations, fruit and vegetables, all of our crops, vineyards, apple orchards. I mean, it affects all aspects of agriculture throughout the state.
I did read yesterday, going through some USDA data, that blueberries are doing fine, I think, at least according to your data. What tends to do okay in a dry season? What types of crops?
Oh boy, that is a good question. all crops are going to require water,
sure,
obviously. And the problem with what we're dealing with here is the, as all of you would know, you can drive a mile down the road and it'd be raining in one spot and not raining in another spot.
That's so true.
So the blueberries, we're hearing anyhow, and in most cases, the crop has been pretty good, although there are areas that have been lacking in water, and their blueberries are struggling a little bit more. I mean, the root system for blueberries goes much deeper than some of our other crops, you know, because they're a perennial crop, where your annual crops struggle more because their root system doesn't go as deep. So where our topsoil right now is so dry, they're not getting the moisture that they need. So
that's
why there's a little bit difference.
Yeah, so what does that mean for corn, for example?
Well, corn, corn root system does go a little bit deeper. Our corn that's being grown for silage purposes, for feeding cattle, is doing a little bit better than our sweet corn. There again, it's so, it you know, depending on where you are in the state, certainly Hillsborough County, Rockingham County, and that southeastern part of Stratford County are the areas where we're really struggling the most.
Well, and what about apple season in the fall? In addition to picking blueberries, you know, that's a favorite fall pastime for a lot of Granite Staters.
Well, the apple crop is a totally different situation because it wasn't, this year's apple crop hasn't been affected so much by the drought as it was by the fact that we had that real cold snap. I mean, can't remember the dates, but I believe it was in first part of March or something like that.
Sure.
Just about the time that the apple trees started to blossom, we got to froze the blossoms, and a lot of them did not turn into producing apples at all.
You know,
so our apple crop is definitely going to be struggling this year. As in comparison to last year, we had a very, very good year.
Some farmers have said, Bruce, and I wonder what you think about this, they've said that all the publicity about the drought has also, pardon the pun, dried up some consumer interest. People have been hearing about this drought, and they think, well, why go to the farmer's market? There won't be anything available. What's your perspective on that?
I was at the Wolfboro Farmers Market here a few weeks ago, and I thought the turnout was extremely good. I know talking to some of our other producers at some of the farmers markets, the reports I've been getting have been very positive.
Aside from issuing warnings about water use from government agencies such as DES, Department of Environmental Services, such as your agency, the USDA, what's the next step, Bruce, addition to these water warnings?
As far as the USDA is concerned, we, as the state executive director for the Farm Service Agency, I also serve as the chair of the State Emergency Board, and we actually had a meeting yesterday in reference to the drought, and what we after the meeting, it was a motion made to send in for a secretarial disaster designation, and
a federal disaster declaration.
It's a secretarial disaster,
which
is a Secretary of Agriculture.
Got it.
So the process there is the governor we fill out the paperwork and send it to her. She will forward it to the Secretary of Agriculture and apply for a secretarial disaster. Now, that will only apply to agriculture, but it does what it does is that
provide some relief for farmers,
right,
loan forgiveness and
exactly.
So forth.
It would be eligible to farmers, and it helps them recover from losses or damages to their crop or livestock, and it also allows for low-interest financing to repair physical damages and stuff like that.
Well, Bruce, thank you very much for being with us, and good luck to you and the farmers in New Hampshire.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Bruce Seely, New Hampshire State Director of the USDA Farm Service Agency. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, New Hampshire's drought and the impacts it's having on our state. Let's hear from you. What are you seeing in your area? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns about the drought, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Mary Stampone, state climatologist and an assistant professor of geography at UNH. Also, Brandon Kernan, senior hydrologist with New Hampshire's Department of Environmental Services. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Bob in Sullivan who says, I attended a water usage planning meeting in Keene a few years ago and was surprised to learn that the state fish hatchery is the largest water user. Bob asks what is being done to regulate their water usage. Also, he asks, what are bottled water companies doing during the drought? Are they continuing as usual, or are they required to cut back on their consumption? Bob, two good questions. Thank you for the email. And Brandon, you want to jump in on either one of those?
Sure. Relative to bottled water, we get that question a lot. There's a lot of concern with the image of pumping water out of the ground, putting it in a truck and driving away.
From the state, right?
Right. But what people need to remember is essentially the same things happening when you're taking water and you're irrigating your lawn. It's not going back to the environment. It's being evaporated or transpired by the vegetation. In New Hampshire, bottled water is not a significant use of our resources. There's only four functioning facilities, and they're all pretty small at this point. The companies have been closing in New Hampshire.
Really? Bottled water companies have been closing in New Hampshire?
That's correct. There hasn't been a new facility that's really open and operated on a large scale in probably about 20 years or so in the state. There's a lot of proposals, but they don't go through. So bottled water, it's less than 0.5% of the groundwater use in the state, and it's really while it's important to make sure that it's properly being managed at the local level where it's occurring and that wells and environmental resources aren't being impacted, it doesn't really affect the water budget of the state in any significant way. Relative to the fish hatcheries, I'm not sure what their pumping rates are right now, but their typical operation model is to be by a river and to pump water into tanks that overflows into a river, and the wells that they're pumping from are generally connected to the river. So they're kind of taking water out of the ground and putting it in the river, and so it's not a wholesale displacement of water from the basin, so to speak. It may be changing its location in a small area, but it's not the same type of impact of pumping it and spraying it in the air and having it evaporate and benefit nothing other than the grass.
Okay, well, thank you for the email, Bob. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's take a call. This is Joan in Meredith. Hi, Joan. You're on the air. Welcome. Joan in Meredith, are you with us? Okay. Joan, I hope you call back. The number 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Paula in Concord who says, I lived on board sailboats at sea for many months of many years. Sailing craft have water tanks of fixed volume, yet our fresh water needs for personal hygiene, dishwashing and drinking remain the same as our needs when ashore with plentiful supply. Paula says, here are a few hints that dramatically reduce freshwater consumption and waste. Do not leave taps running while brushing your teeth. Do not leave taps running while washing dishes. Do not leave taps running while showering or shampooing hair. In all cases, do the soapy work first and only then turn on the taps for the rinse. Paula, thank you for the advice. Mary, do you think most people operate that way?
Maybe for part of it.
Brushing your teeth, a lot of
yeah,
people probably
that's,
shut that off.
They taught me that when I was really little.
Yeah.
It just makes sense. Some of the other things, maybe not so much. But there are so many ways, little ways that you can conserve water. And drought or not, it's always good to do that.
What are you doing in your own life during this drought time, Mary? I just wonder, as someone who's involved in this in an expert way, what changes have you made, if any?
Oh, we don't water our lawn, and we'll hand water our vegetable garden. We usually do a pretty good job of conserving anyway, with especially indoor water use. But yeah, it kind of translates outdoors. And we typically don't water all that much to begin with. And now we just don't do it at all. We used to have a rain barrel, but it's been repurposed. So we need to get that back out.
Repurposed. I think a lot of people listening, myself included, are going, ooh, what about that rain barrel? Why is hand watering so important, Mary?
Well, you know, you're there doing it. You can watch the water. You can kind of monitor how much water you're putting into it. So you're just generally going to use less.
Instead of running the sprinkler
yes.
system where who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows how long? Do you want to jump in on that too, Brandon? There's been a lot of emphasis on hand water your flowers or your vegetables.
Well, it just ensures that you put just the right amount of water in just the right place. So by doing that, you're making sure that you're just not, it's not watering not essential vegetation such as the turf, that you're taking care of your garden and producing the food that you want. And that's where all the water's going to.
We've talked a lot about the water supply, private wells, water systems, and, of course, farming. Joining us now with another perspective on this drought is Brad Simpkins. He's director of New Hampshire's Division of Forest and Lands. And, Brad, welcome.
Thank you.
So, increased forest fires this year. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so this has been a busy year. In a normal year, we have kind of two fire seasons, spring, April, and early May, you know, after things start to get warm but before green up. And then it usually slows down during the summer because everything's nice and green. And then we see another little spike of fires in the late fall after the vegetation cures. What we've seen this year is basically the fire season has been steady since mid-April. We had fires throughout May, throughout June, and throughout July. So we're certainly, we've burned about 540 acres so far this year. To put that in perspective, in an average year, we burn about 240 acres for the entire year. So we're already about 225% of average in the acres burned of where we would be for a full year.
Wow,
so
I'm struck by that. Yeah. That's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's burning, Brad? Is it more forest? Is it more brush? Is it more fields? What is it?
Well, it's primarily the forest. What happens when we see these drought conditions is the upper layers of the surface, what we call the duff, which is the decaying leaves and needles and sticks and things like that, just below the surface, that gets very dry. And so even though the surface may get damp from dew or a light shower or something, once that duff layer gets dry, it takes a while to regain moisture. And so when we see droughts, even though lightning during a normal year is not something that causes a lot of fires because we typically get rain with lightning, what we're seeing this year is lightning strikes are causing brush fires because the lightning will go down into the ground and it'll ignite that duff layer, and it can smolder for days until the surface dries out, and then the fire will pop up. So that's certainly a concern we have when lightning starts causing fires. The other thing is because it's dry in the ground, it takes a lot more labor to extinguish the fires. It's not just a surface fire. You're digging and, you know, the roots are burning, the stumps are burning, things like that. So it makes control difficult.
Wow. So a lightning-induced fire sounds especially difficult to manage. You don't know when exactly it started, and it's kind of working underground before you can get
right.
control of it.
Right. And also just, you know, a lot of times lightning fires are in not the easiest location to get to, you know, up on a side of a mountain somewhere or something like that. So oftentimes they're in difficult or remote areas that you can't maybe get trucks into or something. So it's pretty labor intensive.
What other sources of fire have you seen? You know, careless campfires, for example. What else have you seen has been causing some of these fires that you talk about?
Sure. Campfires is certainly one. Our number one cause of wildfires in the state has been for a number of years people burning debris. So they, you know, burn a pile of brush in their backyard or something. They turn their back on it or they think it's out, but it's not. And then it gets away from them. So that's normally our number one cause. You know, a lot of towns, the town forest fire wardens and things have been cautioning people when they come in for permits, if the town's even still issuing permits, saying, you know, please don't burn now or be very careful. So we're not seeing as many starts from debris burning now, but we are seeing them from like the campfires because the nice sunny weather, you know, people are out, things like that in the woods. And because the ground is so dry, it can be very deceiving. A fire can look like it's out, but if there's any embers left, that can sit there and smolder. And it may smolder for a couple days, and then, you know, it gets dry, a breeze or something, and it pops up. So that's between the lightning and campfires, those are certainly keeping us busy.
So what differences have you seen around the state, Brad, in terms of, you know, we've had a lot of fires in the mountains or we've had a lot of fires on the seacoast? Where does it seem to be especially problematic?
It seems to be basically where the U.S. Drought Monitor is showing the driest, the Cheshire, Hillsborough, Rockingham, and Stafford County areas, the Merrimack River Valley, kind of up into a little bit of the Southern Lakes region. That seems to be where we've been getting the most fire activity. We have had some fires in the north, but Coos, Grafton, and at least the northern part of Carroll County We haven't been seeing the fire activity like we have in the southern tier.
So if somebody wants a fire permit to burn debris and so forth, they usually get that locally. Is that how it works, Bren?
Yeah, that's correct. Every town in the state has a forest fire warden. They're appointed by our agency, but they work at the town level. And any open burning in the state when the ground isn't covered with snow requires a permit. We do have an online permit system. But if someone goes online to get that permit, the town warden is automatically notified that that permit was gotten. You can also still go to the local fire department to get that permit. And that's really when the education between the warden and the landowner occurs as far as, you know, what conditions are, is it favorable to burn. Some towns, because of the continued dryness, have stopped issuing permits for the time being. Some towns are issuing maybe just like Category 1, which is like a small campfire-type permit, but not issuing permits for anything larger. So it's important for people, if they do plan to do any burning, to check with their town fire department and warden to see whether they're issuing permits and whether open burning is even legal at this point.
Wow. So could it get so bad, Brad, that you at the state level issue a statewide ban on open burning? It sounds like that's not what's happening now.
Yeah, that's certainly something we can do. And so we monitor the situation very closely. If we can either do it at the statewide level or county or counties. We typically would not go below a countywide level. So we monitor conditions, activity, and how many towns have already shut off permit issuing, and then we can do something from the state level. The thing that makes it kind of difficult during this time of year is, you know, you typically don't get a real even rainfall over a large area. You may have a thunderstorm cell that pops up and, you know, drops an inch of rain in one town, and the next town over didn't get a drop.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we really you know, kind of count on the local wardens to help us determine when it's too dry in their town to issue permits. Because one town may say, well, we got a lot of rain yesterday, I'm going to allow permits for today, whereas the next town over didn't get anything, and they said, well, we're not issuing any permits. And so we kind of monitor that on a statewide level. But once it gets to a certain level, we can shut off at the county or larger level.
You know, I've heard, Brad, that it's been a great year for camping, that the state's campgrounds are doing great because it hasn't been raining.
Yeah.
So people have said, hey, you know, let's get out there. Have some campgrounds had to tell campers you can't have that nice fire with the marshmallows?
We're not aware of any campgrounds that have shut down. You know, certainly we work pretty closely. The town wardens and the state work pretty closely with the campgrounds. In our administrative rules, the public and private campgrounds actually have some additional safety precautions for fire prevention that they take. So we usually do not see issues with actual campgrounds. What we do see is, you know, the people who go off on the end of a Class 6 road and start a fire on a Friday night or something and then leave Saturday morning, and that gets away. But actually organized campgrounds are usually very good with fire prevention, so we don't see much of an issue with campgrounds.
All right. Well, Brad, real interesting stuff. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Brad Simpkins, Director of New Hampshire's Division of Forests and Lands. And Brandon and Mary, a couple more emails that I'd love to share with you. Here's one from Michael in Warner. He says, we have always conserved water and used 2 50-gallon rain barrels to capture and retain rain. We then hand water or siphon feed our vegetable garden. Michael says, we consider a green lawn a luxury that is not worth the water. Infuriating, he says, to see neighbors with sprinkler systems set to timers that irrigate even during rain events, a waste of water and electricity. Michael, thank you so much for the email. And I wonder what you think about that, Brandon. Is a green lawn these days a luxury that just isn't worth it?
It's really a cultural thing that it would be great if people could think about it differently. The lawn goes beyond just all the water that's being consumed, disappearing from our environment. It's the chemicals that you're putting in the ground. It's the impacts on your neighbor's wells, your neighbor's water quality, and it's the runoff of the fertilizers and the pesticides into our rivers, streams, and lakes. You can find them all in those water bodies if you look for it, and it has to do with our societal desire to have lush green lawns. And I just want to point out there are ways to have a reasonable lawn without using all that water and all those chemicals, you know, by having the right amount of topsoil, by planting the right type of grass, and by dealing with less than an optimal lawn when you have a severe drought. And so people can still have the benefits of a lawn without using tons of water and all those chemicals, and that's really be a great way to shift as we look into the future.
Michael, thank you for the email. Here's another one from Matt in Manchester. He says, to find a small bit of silver lining in New Hampshire's drought, Matt says, I'm an environmental scientist and frequently work outdoors. Early in summer and in previous years, I would pull dozens of ticks off me at the end of a field day. More recently, Matt says, I haven't found a single tick on me in my last three outings. I attribute this decline to New Hampshire's drought. Matt, I had a similar experience with mosquitoes. I went camping recently and realized at the end of the weekend I hadn't seen a single mosquito, which is a very unusual occurrence. Mary Stampone, so what's it going to take to end this? How much rain, whether you want to measure it in terms of days or inches, how much rain is it going to take to put us back to a more normal setting?
What we really need is several multi-day steady overcast cool rain events, some probably during the fall to do this, because it takes more than just what that precipitation deficit that I talked about earlier, because we do lose some of that water to evaporation and runoff. And so that would kind of be like a bare minimum of what we would need. And so, you know, hoping for a fairly wet fall would be good. And then, of course, a decent snowfall season over the course of the winter to ensure that this doesn't linger on into next year.
And just last chance for you, Brandon, to give us a message again from Department of Environmental Services. You guys released a statement just yesterday on this.
Yes, it is an emergency situation in the southern part of the state where we are in a severe drought. It's a different kind of emergency than we normally have, and we're responding to a natural emergency. But drought is an emergency, and we don't know how long it's going to persist. So it's important that we reduce discretionary water uses now so that we are protecting ourselves and our neighbors for the future.
Okay. Brandon, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Brandon Kernan, Senior Hydrologist with New Hampshire's Department of Environmental Services. Mary Stampone, good to see you. Thank you also for coming in. Mary Stampone, State Climatologist and an Associate Professor of Geography at UNH. Remember, the conversation always continues online on our Facebook page and at nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.